I'm speaking today with Harris County District Attorney Pat Lykos. First question I'd like to ask you, when you first ran for this office in 2008, has the job been what you thought it would be when you...
It has, in many instances. What was surprising was the opposition to reform, both inside and outside the office.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that, because, you know, 4 years ago at this time, I think it's fair to say the district attorney's office was in some turmoil with the revelations about your predecessor, Chuck Rosenthal, and him resigning and so on and so forth. Let's start by saying, you know, give me an overview of where the office was then and where it is now.
There were many members of the community that distrusted the office, and my goal was to restore trust and confidence in the office and to make it, transform it into a 21st century district attorney's office worthy of the people of Harris County. When I took office, we discovered that there was a $5 million budget deficit. And in 2009, in September, the county froze any hiring, couldn't replace anyone. And so, working within those constraints, the incredible people in the office, the team I brought in, we've accomplished many goals. To give you some idea of what I discovered when I entered office is that there was over $300,000 in what was the victim witness program that I turned into victims' rights. So when a victim calls up, it's not push one for this or two for that. There's a real person to talk to. And discovering that well over $250,000 had not been distributed, I took a look at it, and it was in boxes, in paper files, and so forth. So I had a database built. All of that was entered into the database. All the incoming entered into that database. And we discovered that one of the employees at the district attorney's office had embezzled about $250,000 from victims. So not only did we discover that, successfully prosecute that individual, but we have distributed that backlog.
Okay. Now, as you said, you discovered there were a lot of oppositions to reform. Let's talk about that a little bit more.
Well, I want to talk about some of the things that I discovered.
Okay. All right. Keep going, then.
If you don't mind.
Go right ahead, please.
Further discovered that there were 600 warrants outstanding for accused capital murderers and murderers. And we have 22 criminal district courts. And those warrants were in 22 different file drawers, and no one was looking for them. And so did the same thing again. Every single file was read. All the data in those files was entered into the database and so forth. And we discovered some of them were useless. The accused was white male, 25, John Smith. Or Jose Garcia, Hispanic male, 30. Well, how are you going to identify somebody or arrest them for that? But we further discovered that there was very little investigation to identify individuals. So many of them had used alias names. And so with good sleuthing, if you will, and going out, our investigator, who incidentally is going to receive an award from the 100 Club, talked to acquaintances, neighbors, and so forth, and discovered real names, discovered dates of birth, so we could enter this information into the Texas Crime Information Center and into the National Crime Information Center, TCIC, NCIC. And it's been an incredible success. New Year's Eve, booked into our jail, were two accused murderers who have been fugitives since 1980. So I can't say enough for what those individuals have done. We have established relationships with the federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies so that we're working together and have that force multiplier. We had legislation passed the first session after I took office so that the agencies in Harris County could combine their sex offender registration. Before, you know, first of all, Harris County is the third largest county in the nation. And we have 34 municipalities, of course, the largest of which is the city of Houston. The population in our unincorporated area rivals that of San Antonio. So we have 1,800 square miles. Contrast that with the state of Rhode Island, which is 1,500 square miles. Our population is greater than that of 24 states. So, and you know we're the energy capital of the world. You know the industry that we have, the ports of entry that we have, the Port of Houston, our aerospace program, the rail, the trucking, and so forth. We're a financial center. We're a cultural center, educational center, have the best medical center in the world here. So we attract the best of the brightest. And also, we're a magnet for the worst of the predators. And every single transnational gang has some sort of presence here. We also, and many people don't understand what the district attorney's office does or should be doing, we're the foremost law enforcement agency. And so our responsibilities are many and complex. To give you an example, it's our obligation to protect the rights when somebody is under investigation, when they're charged with an offense, during the trial, and even post-conviction. And during my administration, we've exonerated four people who were wrongfully convicted. And when somebody's wrongfully convicted, that's a triple tragedy for the individual wrongfully imprisoned, for the victim, and for society because there's no justice. And thirdly, the actual predators are free to reap further depredations. And in every one of these cases, we went a step further and identified the actual culprits. And they did go on to commit aggravated sexual assault, aggravated kidnapping, robbery, and manslaughter. So I'm very proud of what we've done because our post-conviction review is totally independent of the appellate division. So there's no possibility that they could be influenced by others. And
well, it's interesting you bring that up because it often seems like the biggest obstacle to post-conviction review and in particular to actually exonerating people for whom there is later revealed to be evidence of innocence is the local district attorney. I mean, look at the Morton case out in Williamson County. How do you deal with that?
Well, of course, we sift through them. One of the exonerations that we had was a letter that was written to me by an inmate with an affidavit attached to it. And I looked at it and I said, this person either has a credible claim or he's committed aggravated perjury. And if he is, I'm going to come down on my duck like on a June bug. And so we investigated, and it turned out it was his nephew was one of the culprits and never testified in his uncle's defense. And not only did we exonerate him, but we identified the actual perpetrator.
Okay. And
no, that's justice.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's what our mission is to seek justice. And that is a very, very broad definition. To me, it means the rule of law. Okay. Themis, you know, the goddess of justice and order. Now, how do you have order? There's only two ways to have order. You have order when there's justice, when people understand that there is justice. Or you have it through tyranny.
Okay. Well, you know, there's been a lot of advances in forensic science, and also a lot of advances in understanding the way things like eyewitness identification work, advances in understanding the way arson, science of fire works. You know, everyone understands DNA exoneration.
There's not enough advances in arson, unfortunately.
I mean, but everyone understands, you know, when someone is exonerated because a piece of DNA exists to point someone else. You know, what's the mission of your post-conviction review? I mean,
to determine whether people are actually innocent and to identify the actual.
I guess what I'm saying is, do you see a reason to expand its scope and look at more types of cases?
We are inundated as it is. And so it's the individual themselves or someone who's sponsoring them. But we get cases, you know, through the Innocence Project. We look at everything that's submitted to us.
Okay. Let's go back and talk about reform.
I want to talk about the forensic science, though. You got me excited there.
All right.
That was one of my primary issues in the campaign, and that is to have a new Institute of Forensic Forensic Sciences in Harris County.
All right, let's talk about that.
And I am so excited over that because Commissioner's Court just a few weeks ago voted to go ahead with architectural plans and to actually construct. And this is, we're already regional. I mean, the Harris County Institute of Forensic Sciences, the old ME's office, has tested for over 100 agencies. So we already are a regional agency. And now we're going to go forward and we're going to build an interim DNA lab in a McGovern building while the new institute is being built.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing how that goes. The question that I have that often gets raised with these things, you know, traditionally crime labs of one stripe or another have been under the purview of a police department or a district attorney's office.
You're right.
You know, that kind of sets up a conflict of interest, doesn't it? Is this crime lab going to be truly independent?
Yes, it is. It's not being run by me. It's not being run by the chief or the sheriff. So they are divorced, if you will. Not divorced, but you have this independence from law enforcement agencies. What's so great about it is that it's staffed by real scientists, not mere technicians, but real scientists, medical doctors, PhDs. It's located in a medical center, and they have the synergy with the teaching hospitals, with the research centers out there. So we're going to make further advances in forensics in the future. We're going to be the premier forensic center in the world.
Okay.
Can I tell you one other thing?
Go right ahead.
What's really great about
this? Be careful. You pause, I'm going to jump in. So go right ahead.
I'm sorry, but you really have pushed a button with me when you talk about forensics. There's something called touch DNA. And what that is epithelia, you know, mm-hmm. skin mm-hmm. cells and so forth. Or a burglar may cut himself and there's a little drop of blood. To give you an example, a godparent of my nephew had his truck stolen, and it was stripped, and it was found, and he went out, and he met the HPD officer, and the officer took the report. Well, who stole the truck was a dipper, and spit. And so he said, well, aren't you going to swab? And he said, no. And he said, well, you know, why not? He says, because it won't be tested. You know, we've got thousands and thousands of untested rape kits in the HPD crime lab. If that offense had occurred in the county, it would have been tested. Now, what's so salient about this is no one steals one vehicle and retires, burglarizes one and retires, or one building or one habitation. And you know how dangerous burglaries can be, what they can escalate into. And so these are serial prolific criminals, and we can identify them, prosecute them successfully, and imprison them. We have prevented crime. So not only is there justice for the victim, but we've prevented future crimes.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about technology in general. There's been a lot of advances in the county, the district clerk's office, in electronic filing and other moves away from paperwork. What has your office done to advance technology and make it work better for everyone who comes in contact with the office?
We've put primary emphasis on process and on technology. All those screens that you see in the courtrooms, the money came from the forfeiture funds from the DA's office for that, for trials. When I took office, I discovered that it took weeks and weeks and weeks, months, to get 911 tapes. And then often they had been played over, destroyed, whatever. We now have a system set up where electronically we request them. And we're hoping in the future to get them digitally. But right now, we go out and pick them up twice a week. So you see what that has saved in time. Justice is not delayed because we don't have the tape or because the tape is lost. Another thing are subpoenas. They used to be filled out by hand, carried over to the clerk, more hand work on it and so forth. Now, the form is on the screen and it's sent electronically with an electronic signature. I mean, these are advances that have saved incredible amount of man hours, if you will.
Okay.
And those are just a few of them. Before I took office, two women were sexually assaulted by a parolee who was a sex offender, and he had never reported. Well, what the prison system was doing is they were faxing the parole releases of sex offenders out with 34 municipalities in the county. You know what happens with faxes. So we had this bill introduced in the legislature where all the agencies could combine into one. And right now, as we speak, the city of Houston and the sheriff's office are one entity who are monitoring sex offenders. Now, they still wanted to fax them, and I said, hey, you can't do that. You know, we need to get it electronically. They were having a woman who filled it out by hand, slaying there. And I said, well, can't we do it digitally? Well, they said, no, we can't do that. I said, well, how about scanning it and then sending it electronically? Well, we can't afford to scan it. So I said, well, okay, I'll buy you one out of my personal checking account. So now we're getting them that way. So you've got the force multiplier. We've got a better database. But also, they can go out now and see whether they are in compliance, that they are where they're supposed to be.
Let's talk about the jail for a minute, because it's been an ongoing story that up until very recently, Harris County Jail had more inmates than it could handle and was literally sending them out to other counties and even to the state of Louisiana.
You're right.
Recently, they have finally gotten to the point where they don't have to do that anymore. There's a number of reasons for this. People who can't make bail, who are on low-level charges, so on and so forth. What responsibility does the district attorney have? Does the office of the district attorney have for, you know, managing this resource, for ensuring that, you know, we're not putting more people in jail than we can handle?
We have a responsibility for we're both sword and shield to protect and defend our people. So we have, if you will, the macro view. How do we best do that? And a contributing factor to the decline in the jail population and the decline in crime is our TRACE policy.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask about it.
One of the first things that I did when I took office is I met with all of our prosecutors. How can we improve the system? That's how I discovered the 911 tapes. That's how I discovered the problems that we were having with getting things from the property room. I'm not digressing here.
No.
Okay. It used to be that you, as an officer, if you seized evidence, and I'm the prosecutor, I have to meet you at the property room to preserve the chain of custody. Now, you might work midnight to 8, you have to come in on your day off, when you're not working, whatever. Can you imagine all the difficulties that were involved there? Well, what we did was we got with the Houston Police Department and everything, and so much of this now is electronic, and we send over the request, the officer gets it, the officer then takes it and gives it to an individual, and then we go and pick it up. So you preserve your chain of custody, and we do it like this, rather than waiting for somebody to come back off a vacation, whatever the situation, you know, might be. Now, to get to the TRACE policy, their biggest complaint in the felony courts were TRACE cases. And so I immediately began investigating that, and we consulted with the forensic labs throughout the United States. What is the minimum amount that can be tested twice? That's due process, fairness. The state can test it, the defense can test it. I don't think anybody can quarrel with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so the answer was 1/100th of a gram. You know what a gram is?
It's 1/28th of an ounce.
Exactly. You take a Sweet or Splenda packet, that's a gram. So take 1/100th of that and you see what a minute amount that is. The traces that were previously being filed were less than that. You know, somebody might have a little bit on their lip and residue. And then swab it, and of course, you know, it turned color. Oh, well, that's a state jail felony? Do you know when an officer arrests somebody, it's 2 to 3 hours that they're out of service by the time they take them downtown, go through intake, file the charges, and book them? They're off the street in that length of time. So now I'm faced with a due process issue, and everything else is a beneficial byproduct of justice. So then we surveyed the major metropolitan areas in Texas. In Bexar County, San Antonio, their threshold is 1/100th of a gram. Travis County, Austin, 1/100th of a gram. Fort Worth, it's 2/100ths of a gram. Okay. So then, Marshall, with all of this, we met with the sheriff, we met with the HPD and their top command, and made our presentation and said, beginning January 1st of 2010, we will no longer accept any trace cases. It has to be a threshold of 1/100 of a gram. HPD asked us to do a 6-month pilot project on it, which we did. And everything shows that crime has gone down consistently since we implemented this policy. We've made that presentation to the Criminal Justice Council. And on the Criminal Justice Council at that time was my opponent, who was representing the criminal district courts. The sheriff is on it, a representative of the constable's office. All the law enforcement agencies in the county were on it. And I made the presentation. No one voiced any objection to it.
They have since done that. The various law enforcement unions have since come out against it. What do you say to them about that?
Well, union bosses came out against it. Union bosses don't run my office.
Okay.
What I want the officers to do, now bear in mind, burglary of a motor vehicle, if you're a first offender, that's a misdemeanor. But a little flake is a state jail felony. And now stop and think about the ramifications of that also. A young person convicted of a state jail felony, even if they just serve time in a county jail, forever will be denied certain occupations, perhaps a place to reside because they have this criminal record. I want to get people away from drugs. I want law enforcement to go after the dealer, to go after the person who supplied the dealer, the person who supplied that individual. I want to go after the bulk cash and the proceeds of these criminal enterprises. I want to destroy the retail locations. I want to disrupt the operations, and I want to dismantle the criminal organizations.
Let's talk about the DIVRT program that for drunk. I mean, as I understand this, and forgive me, I'm not a lawyer. This was a program that you came up with that allowed for deferred adjudication in drunk driving. Explain the program to me.
It's a diversion program, and it's been the thing that was appalling is that we're the epicenter for driving while intoxicated in Harris County. And so we did an analysis. We use technology a lot. We mine the data to see what true picture is. Most people were turning down probation because there really wasn't any benefit to them to take probation. And so you had young people who would cop a plea for time served. That meant when they were booked into jail and pay a minimal fine. And so now they have a misdemeanor, you know, conviction for driving while intoxicated. That means they don't have a license. You don't have a license, you don't have insurance. And then the next thing you know, they're repeat offenders. And I wanted to stop that slippery slope of recidivism, if you will, that too often leads to intoxication manslaughter. And so we checked with the Greater Houston Council on Alcoholism. We checked with treatment providers, law enforcement agencies. How do we divert people from this ruinous pathway? And that's when we came up with this plan. Number one, there's a risk assessment. And only if you qualify are you eligible to participate in DIVRT. And you have to plead guilty. You have to plead guilty and know that you would receive 30 days in jail, not just the time you spent in jail before you bonded out, and pay a fine. And you have to undergo treatment. And every single one of these individuals has to have an interlock in their car with a camera. And so you're talking about a year to 18 months, depending on what the risk assessment shows. And of those who have successfully completed the program, the recidivist rate is less than 1%. So we feel like that we are saving lives and putting people on the right pathway. And that's one of the things that we've done with respect to juveniles. First offenders, nonviolent offense, Class A, Class B misdemeanor, another risk assessment. And if they qualify, oh, incidentally, on DIVRT, the offender pays for all of this, the treatment and so forth. If they cannot afford it, then the fees that they pay into the system are used to provide the treatment and to provide the interlock to them so that it's fair. It's not for a rich person, okay, or middle-class person. It's for everyone who qualifies. the DIVERT program, we do a risk assessment. If they qualify, oh, incidentally, in DIVERT, if they successfully complete the program, the case is dismissed. We maintain it if they have a repeat offense, of course. Now, what they do in other jurisdictions, I know I'm jumping all over the place, but I'm really excited about the things that we've done and our accomplishments. In other jurisdictions, what they do is they have people go through treatment pretrial. And if they successfully complete it, then they reduce it to obstructing traffic. I think what we do is the better approach. I'm not being critical of any other jurisdiction, but other metropolitan jurisdictions have tried to devise ways of making sure people get into treatment. The legislature, in their interim hearings, has advocated making it statewide to have the program that we have here in Harris County, so I'm proud of that. Talking about our juveniles, do a risk assessment. If they qualify, their parents or our guardians come to us. We offer them a contract. The kids are placed under supervision. Number one, you have to stay in school. You can't be truant. We want you to pass. Treatment for the family if it's necessary, drug treatment, whatever it might be. And we've diverted over 4,000 kids successfully. And if they complete the program, no charges are filed. Because if you think a juvenile record is secret, there's a bridge up north that's for sale. If you put one of these kids in detention with gangbangers, we've lost them forever. Again, it's putting them on the right pathway of life. This is, again, crime prevention.
As I understand it, one of the criticisms of DIVERT is that it's not something that was, you know, it's not something that was created as a remedy by the legislature. Is that not the case?
We have power to do pretrial diversions. We have the authority to do that. What would you call reducing a case to obstructing traffic?
Okay. Let's get back to what you mentioned earlier about reforms and obstacles to reform. Okay. What obstacles have you run into?
There was a problem with accountability, and so when you set protocols, when there is accountability, and new things, you know, like we established the first animal cruelty section in the state of Texas, and now we're a model for the state, and other DA's offices are coming to us for us to show them how you start an animal cruelty unit. Dog fighting is pandemic here in Harris County. Parents take their children to dog fights, okay? And the parents are betting as to which dog is going to rip out the throat of another dog. And then at intermission, they're training their crystal meth and their stolen property and so on. So we have put a big emphasis on that to get information from the community, but over and above getting information from the community, what we're doing is we're going out and we're speaking to social workers, to community workers and so forth, because a lot of folks said, well, this is cultural. And now they see it's not cultural. They see it for the evil that it is. So we're transforming public sentiment, if you will, establishing social controls. This should not be done. Hey, fella. Okay, mental health. You see, everything that I'm doing today is based on my whole career. As a police officer, as a lawyer trying cases in family, civil, and criminal courts, as a judge, the activities that I've been involved in, whether it's been teaching, whether it's at South Texas College of Law, the National Judicial College, the activities that I've been involved in, identifying what the problems are, how they affect the criminal justice system. You know, in the late 70s, they deinstitutionalized our mental institutions. And so a third of the people that you see living under the bridges are homeless. They are mentally incapable of caring for themselves. Half of them become victims of crime and end up in the emergency room. A substantial portion of them are arrested for nuisance offenses, dumpster diving, relieving themselves in public. So they go to the emergency room and they're booked into jail. Well, they're booked into jail, and then we have to, again, examine them, diagnose them. They're put on their meds. These beds are very expensive. So we bring them to as much normality as possible. Their lawyer calls them to leave for time served, and they're dumped out on the street with a prescription. okay. Well, you know immediately they're going to go fill them. So some of the things that we've done is we work with other community organizations where they're picked up when they're released and they're taken to get their prescriptions filled and to try to get counseling. What I'd like to see, and we have lawyers assigned to the mental health. I mean, we were the proponents of that. And nothing happens without the DA's office pushing it in this area. What I hope to do is get something called single room occupancy, SROs, whether it's a motel, a dormitory type of facility, where these individuals can be placed there and they have housing, they'll have good nutrition, and there will be people there to dispense their medication so that they have the best quality of life. They're eligible for SSI, and so this would almost pay for itself when you see the enormous cost of paying $150, $200, $300, $400 for those beds in the Harris County Jail that have no long-term success, if you will.
Okay. Recently, there was a grand jury investigation of your office that was completed.
Mm-hmm.
They did not bring forth any charges. This has to do with the bat van, you know, the mobile bat vans that HPD uses to test for
the intoxilizer.
Right.
Two.
The crux of the dispute had to do with who has the contract, and the allegation was that your office improperly moved that someplace else as political payback. You have characterized that investigation as a political hit against you. Why do you say that?
All you have to do is just view the conduct. I mean, all the leaks from that grand jury. You know, when a DWI lawyer can call up a commissioner and say, you've been subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury. This was a corruption of the system, an abuse of the system, and it's horrifying. It's horrifying. The reason for the secrecy of grand juries is you can destroy people's lives. It can be used oppressively. Okay? Curiously, most news accounts omit the fact that we had the bat van intoxilizers tested in the bat van under the conditions that were described by the technician. And the Department of Public Safety is a state authority on breath alcohol testing machines. And they found that her allegations were without merit. So if you let me take you back a little bit in history. In January of last year, HPD Crime Lab had 3 technicians. At the beginning of May, they had 0. They never informed us. They quit the blood alcohol testing in February, didn't inform us, that they were losing these 3. The last technician, who is the one who's represented by a DWI attorney who seems to know more about what the grand jury did than a grand jury, she filed 3 affidavits before she left, attesting to the reliability of the intoxilizer machines. And then when she was subpoenaed to court, she says, I want to get paid as an expert witness. Well, we're not going to pay an individual to be an expert witness who had been employed by a law enforcement agency. Then she testifies in July and says, well, I don't know whether I can say that in this case it's reliable because HPD has all my records and I don't know whether they handled them correctly or whatever. And so we immediately sent out a Brady notice notifying the prosecutors and the attorneys that this technician had raised questions about her tests. Then, sometime later in the month, she says, you know, I don't think any of the intoxilizers from the bat vans are reliable back to 2009. Now, we took a statement from her the first time. We took another statement from her the second time. She says, now, I don't know whether they're reliable. They never have been tested because of the air conditioning. And they did have air conditioning problems. And the ambient temperature has to be at a certain level. And the DPS found that if it isn't at the proper level, then either you get no test results, or if you get a test result, it's actually lower than what the actual alcohol content is. We did everything right. We did the right thing, and we're being pilloried for it. Now, I guess 2 years ago, we were notified that there were hundreds of cases where a contract person was supposed to go and actually calibrate machines or recalibrate them and didn't do it. We sent out Brady notices on every one of those cases. How could anyone believe that I would compromise, or anyone in my office would compromise, our honor for a handful of the so-called bat ban cases? In fact, one individual came to me, talk about being cynical. They said, you know what you should have done? You should have dismissed all those cases and blamed it on the crime lab. Oh, I can't do something like that. When somebody tells me that there's a problem with the test results, I have to vouch for expert testimony. I have to be sure that they're reliable, okay? On the other hand, am I going to summarily dismiss cases and let possibly dangerous drivers back on the streets with no consequences for their action, no trial to determine their guilt or innocence? I did the right thing. Our office did the right thing. Yes.
Okay.
I believe it was politically motivated. With respect to that contract, no contract was rescinded. We simply, and I issued a press release, it was all above board, I recommended that the county contract go to the Department of Public Safety. The reason for that is they're the state authorities. I don't have to worry about them ending up with no technicians. But over and above that, it now means that if you as an HPD officer are closer to Bel Air, you can take someone to Bel Air to be tested. If the sheriff's office is closer to HPD, they can take them. If HPD is closer to the sheriff's office where they're located. So you've got this efficiency, if you will. And then we went a step further and we gave a grant to HPD. They've got four command stations now that are being remodeled, and they're putting in intoxilizer machines and that video audio, and it's digital. You know how we're getting that right now? VHS tapes. And so to reproduce them, it has to buy minute by minute by minute. This is the 21st century. Well, at least it's not Betamax, okay? So you see how the process improves the administration of justice. The sooner that someone is tested, that's the best evidence at the time of arrest, okay? At these command stations, the officers will be able to book them and not have to take them downtown, and that means they're back out on the streets quicker. I mean, it's just a win-win situation.
Okay. It's
logical.
Let me ask you also about, you know, as we speak today, the FBI and the Texas Rangers were called in to address some complaints that they had received, that your office had conducted investigations of members of the grand jury, judge, and I believe some other people involved in that grand jury hearing. How do you address that?
Should there be any investigation, we would cooperate fully with the authorities. And I would hope that if indeed the FBI and the Texas Rangers were involved, they would examine what occurred with the grand jury and the conduct of that grand jury. Now,
was it the case that your office, let's talk about what your office actually did. When the story came out, you originally said that it was public, you know, public information, Google searches, that sort of thing. Your investigator, Mr. McWilliams, has since put out a statement that described an initial request that used Google searches and a subsequent request that used a database called, I believe it's Accurate.
Well, actually, you have that reversed.
Okay, sorry. One okay. Used Accurate and the other didn't.
You have to understand that this grand jury went rogue. They were calling in witnesses. Under the law, we're required to be present when any witnesses are before a grand jury. And they said no. And even to the point of there was almost a confrontation. And so our people left. Several witnesses had testified or had gone before them. We don't know what they said or did, okay, before this grand jury. This is absolutely, as I said, road. We were extremely concerned about whether there was manipulation there. And the chief investigator's statement speaks for itself. That's what he did. And I believe he checked on two individuals, and it was a minimal inquiry. And these are subscription-based. We had an absolute right to try to determine what was happening with the grand jury. The judge should have had the grand jury make a presentation and appointed pro tems. The judge did not do that until we educated her when we filed our mandamus. Once the mandamus was filed, we stopped. I mean, once she appointed the pro tems, we stopped.
Okay. So...
And on the day of the news conference...
You like it? More coffee?
I'm fine right now, thank you.
Yeah.
I read the statement, which grand juries... I mean, the Attorney General's already issued an opinion. Grand juries should not make public statements, okay? And still, again, contrary to the law, that was done. Press conference. And then the same DWI lawyer just happened to be there at the time and made his pejorative remarks about our office. So I read the statement, and I called our investigator who was homesick. And I said, did you conduct any investigation? And he said, no. Emphatically, no. Now, you know what an investigation is.
Yes.
And so, I responded the way I did. There was no investigation.
Okay. Well, we've talked for a long time, and I appreciate... Well, go ahead.
Would you have us do if you have a rogue grand jury that's proceeding contrary to law?
I'm happy to say I've never been in that situation myself.
No, you have a responsibility. You have a responsibility to the people of Harris County. You have a responsibility for all the DA's offices and the entire state of Texas. When the judge and the grand jury did not follow the law. So, other things that we've done is, and there was initial resistance by some to this, and that is, we give offense reports to defense attorneys.
Offense reports to defense attorneys.
It used to be like it was in the old days when I was practicing law. You'd have to go down there and they let you look at the file and you'd have to make notes and so forth. Now, our prosecutors read the file, which means they're familiar with the facts so that when they go to court for the initial hearing, they're prepared. And they redact things that should be, like Social Security numbers and maybe medical information, whatever is required under the law. And we have a contract with the lawyers that they don't give this to their clients. Now, the sooner the defense attorney and the defendant know the evidence against them, the quicker cases are resolved. So you have a lot more cases pleading out, and they're pleading out quicker because they've seen the evidence. Why shouldn't we give discovery? I mean, we're defending our republic as well as the people of Harris County. It's called due process.
I appreciate the time you've taken talking to me. We've covered a lot of ground here. Let me conclude by noting, you know, you do have an opponent now in your primary.
Can I talk about some more of our initiatives? Can I talk to you about Haverstock and what we did there?
Sure thing. But let me have you say that as we wrap this
all
up,
right,
by saying, you know, why should people in the Republican primary, whenever we get to have that, vote to make you once again the Republican nominee for district attorney?
I kept my promises. Every single promise that I made during the campaign, I have kept. And we've made Harris County safer. We have built our office into a model for the nation. You know, and we're going to be the best DA's office in the whole entire United States in my second term. I talked about mental health then. I talked about protecting society. We've done it with our child exportation. We to protect the most vulnerable, the elderly, and the children. our legislative initiatives that we've engaged in and had various laws changed so that we can go after pharmaceutical diversions. Our relationships with the federal, state, and local agencies where we're working together to bring back fugitives from other countries, not just other states and so forth, where we're working together to combat these transnational criminal organizations. I promised all of that, and I've kept my promises. And I have restored community faith and trust in our office.
Okay. Harris County District Attorney Pat Likos.
I walk down the street, and working people come up to me, and they kind of give me the sidelong, look and everything. I say, howdy, good morning, I'm Pat Likos. And they reach over, and they touch me, and they say, thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for talking to me today. I appreciate it.